Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Leenie. And I'm really happy to be here. I see some old people that I probably met 7 years ago, and a lot of new faces too. So I wanna thank you for inviting me and thank the people who helped set things up. And thank you for taking such good care of Canando. And hello to everybody online. So just as when we sit or when we do a sesshin, doing a practice period is a chance to turn inward to whatever it is that we turn to, and a chance to look at the self in relation to mystery. I was very fortunate to be able to attend the winter practice period at Tassajara. Some of you know Tassajara better than I do. So it was my first chance to attend. Tassajara was founded in 1967 by the San Francisco Zen Center when I was 7 years old. And I heard about it when I was 18. And it took until I was 62 to finally visit. So again, I feel very fortunate. It was a 90-day practice period. And also, I think as many of you know, the Ango, which is a tradition in our practice, actually even predates Buddha's time, is an opportunity for intensive practice. It's an ascetic practice, an opportunity to have just enough in our life, whether that's just enough sleep or just enough food. Much of the day is silent. It's spent in study, meditation, and work. Of course, the difference between a sesshin and a sitting like this tonight is that it's longer. And so it asks a lot of you. And that's the one thing in talking to a lot of people about what a practice period was, who'd been to past practice periods, said that practice period, especially at Tassajara, asks a lot of you. So what I wanted to do tonight is share with you some of the teachings. It's a bit of a mosaic of things that I learned. Or heard or appreciated. The location in and of itself was a teaching. Tassajara is located in a valley, beautiful deep valley in the Ventana wilderness, where 17 hot springs are located. It's at the intersection of two creeks, which were both pretty much rivers while I was there, if you remember the rainfall in January. And there is something called the Mountains and River Sutra, and there's a reason why the Mountains and River Sutra is one of our teachings. It's Dogen's writing, because the mountains are a place to practice. Dogen writes, to be in the mountains is to be a flower opening in the world. And the monk Jirshu asks, what sort of person dwells in the mountains? And the person who dwells in the mountains is a common phrase for a person of the way or a person of thusness. So to be a monk, which is what you are when you go to a practice period at Tassajara, in the mountains is a time-old tradition. And it's a way of opening up to those mountains. It's not just the mountains and rivers, it's also the sky and the stars. And my diary entry one night when the rain finally stopped was, saw the stars, jaw dropped. And that's the feeling, the awe that I often had there. Les gave me three teachings while I was at Tassajara. And all of them were short. I think less than even a sentence, really. And perhaps the teaching that I worked with the most and that scared me the most was to study the self is enlightenment itself. And the mountains were the backdrop for that. And I would go for long walks when you had time, which was really only on personal days, which were every 4 or 5 days. Monk's week is 4 or 5 days, depends. Long walks, and I would study not only myself, but the mountains and myself in relation to the mountains. That's really all that one needs to do. They provided perspective. They provided a certain boundlessness, and they provided their own training. One of the teachers said, let life enter you the way music enters you. And I felt that way about the mountains. So those were the mountains. And so now imagine monks with their long black robes, tripping over our long black robes half the time, with the rain pouring down and big umbrellas. The lucky people had really big umbrellas. So it was a beautiful scene. It was like something out of a Japanese painting. Imagine the valley with Tassajara Creek in front, with the sun rising on one side of the valley and setting on the other side. And then imagine Flag Mountain, in the background. And this was the feeling that really set the setting for me. Monks running back and forth, the mountain always there, and the sun rising and the sun setting. Gratitude every day for that sunrise and that sunset and the monks. So that's the second set of teachings, which is community and communal living. There were about 20 or 25 people there. Normally, a practice period is about 60 to 70. So it was a very unusual time. Everybody had a task. We were all dependent on one another. Some people had multiple tasks because it was such a small group. Sometimes we were only 12 people in the Zendo having oryoki meals. So it was a very intimate group. And sweet. I felt sometimes like a cross between summer camp and, I don't know if you know the reality show Survivor, but the game of Survivor is in some ways supporting each other, but also figuring out how to get along with each other so people keep you in the game. And after the first week or so, I noticed people building community by trying to be nice to each other. And this was Les's second teaching to me, which was study bodhisattva virtues. And so I paid attention to, of course, people were being helpful and friendly and smiling, but there were also apologies for an ill-spoken word. People took the time to rethink what had just happened in an interaction and then come back and say, oh, you know, that wasn't really what I intended. And then we would talk about it. Or the surprise of flowers put in the room when we finished our Tangario period. Somebody energetically cleaning the bathroom, you know, not just cleaning the bathroom, but energetically cleaning the bathroom. One of the cooks getting up at 3 to make us pastries because she was inspired to make pastries. Another woman at 9 o'clock at night checking the temperature of the baths to make sure that they were hot enough the next day. And a crew of 3 very dedicated men who would keep the geothermal heat system working by fixing the water pump, which had to be pulled when the rains were too high. So we were without heat for a couple of weeks during the practice period, which allowed me to feel like I experienced some of what you experienced less when you were there, but only for a couple of weeks. The cold. So these bodhisattva virtues were a teaching by observing, and we know that that the people around us are always our teachers. But when we had conversations, even on the personal days, it was often about Dharma, and I got a lot out of that as well. Some of the conversations, often on the way to the bathhouse, were points of support. Somebody would say, can you feel compassion for that? That was a common phrase. Or can you feel compassion for the pain? Because we would often talk about what was hurting. There are observations such as, is it enough? Is our practice enough? That one still rattles around in me, especially when I think about movements like Black Lives Matter. Is our practice enough? We would have confessions, noting our greediness. On personal day, they served us cookies. The first time I went, I had no cookies. The second time, I think I had one. I worked my way up to 3 cookies by the end of the practice period. And then there were some intractable questions, like, do I have moral responsibility for the actions of somebody else? There were some very egregious situations, you know, people who had dealt with really serious transgressions, moral transgressions, you know, of people in their circles. And were they responsible because they helped that person in some way in relation to that transgression? Some people dealt with very deep guilt. And how much should we strive to do better in our practice versus just accepting what is? This was around the chanting. Our chanting was miserable. We'd have this room, this part of the room competing with that part of the room. It wouldn't come together. And we had multiple talks about this as a Sangha. And at the end, it was just something we, I think, mostly came to accept. But it went back and forth between striving and accepting. And I loved one woman who said, Zen is good. You can disagree. You can really disagree based on what you know inside to be true. So that was important. And then people gave way-seeking mind talks. Everybody was encouraged to give way-seeking mind talks. And the most important teaching for me there was a woman recounting being in Plum Village and listening to Thich Nhat Hanh. And Thich Nhat Hanh held out a tangerine. And he said, this is a miracle. And then he said, and you are too. And the woman said, that transformed her. Third set of teachings were the formal teachings. So we had a theme about bowing. Linda Ruth Cutts was our teacher, and she had been wanting to study bowing for some time, and she used this as an opportunity to talk about bowing. And my favorite bowing story was about a Tibetan monk, actually, Mila Arepa. I remember him because I like arepas, and I think about 1,000 arepas. But Mila Arepa is living in a cave. He's a cave dweller, and he goes out to gather firewood. And when he comes back to his cave, he discovers that there are demons in the cave. And he tries to chase them out, and they become even more fierce, as we know. And then he decides, well, I'll just sit back and teach the Dharma, teach them about impermanence, teach them about suffering, teach them about no self. And they just kind of went, phew. And then he started going to each of the demons, one by one, one by one. And he bowed to them. And he said, teach me what you know. And they disappeared, one by one. But there was one demon that stayed behind. And he had flaring nostrils and was very scary. Milarepa, and his mouth was open. Milarepa put his head inside the demon's mouth and he said, eat me. And he offered his full self and the demon bowed to him and disappeared. So many meanings of bowing. For me, that one is the one I think that I use in my practice the most, is bowing to my demons. We were taught the practicalities of bowing. Fist distance from the face, fingertips by the nose, keep the distance as you bow, don't do this kind of thing. And feel the circle of your heart in your hands, as well as the warmth as you bring your hands together. I like the image, even if I can't always feel the warmth. One of the teachers said that gratitude, which is what I often feel when I bow, is good. So I try to remember that every bow is good, every bow, and it's a good thing to bow. But even though that was the main set of teachings, and we did a lot around, you know, Ru Jing's teaching to Dogen about bowing. I don't know how many of you know that, but I'll mention that chant in a moment to you. But a lot of other teachings were important too that were formal teachings. So when we did Tangaryo, which is when you sit, if you're a new student, you sit for 5 days straight without any kinhin, without any service, you just sit as a way of showing your dedication. The practice leader said to us, first of all, she said, the most important thing is just to do it. Don't worry about how good your practice is. And then she said, let your mind be at ease. And remember, this is the first time and the only time in your life you will do this. And the let your mind be at ease is, you know, don't fuss with your cushions, let your mind be more flexible. And the first time and only time you will do this is just like every moment, right? So that was something that stayed with me during the practice period as well. Every time I started to be a little bit discouraged, I would think, this is the first time and this is the only time I'm experiencing this moment in this practice period. We also celebrated Martin Luther King Day. And, you know, I think there's a certain eclecticism to our practice in that we can take in, you know, Buddhist thinking from many, many different sources. And one of the Sangha members contributed Martin Luther King's teaching about power and love, where power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose, and how love and power are often considered to be polar opposites to each other. But the quote from Martin Luther King that's really powerful for me is that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And one reason why that was meaningful for me is that as part of this practice period, I'm also trying to write several essays related to social change and Buddhist ethics and Buddhist practice. So it's been very difficult. I have no idea what I'm supposed to say. The 5 essays are still pending, but it's a topic that's very dear to me and welcome conversations around it. All right, so Ru Jing, I want to mention, because this is a practice that one can do or that one can be with. And Ru Jing gave this as a kind of a going away present, as I understand it, to Dogen to take back to Japan. So Ru Jing was Dogen's teacher in China. And he said, the chant is, the one who is bowing, the one who is bowed to. And you do this while you're bowing. So the first bow is the one who is bowing, the one who is bowed to, their nature, no nature. The second bow, my body, other's body, not to. And the third bow, plunging into the inexhaustible vow, living in harmony with all. And Norman has another version of that, which I don't remember right now, but there are several versions of this chant. And of course, also the 3 bows are to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But if one has a very discursive mind and Buddha, Dharma, Sangha doesn't do it, chanting this while you're bowing is also useful. And we were asked to do 108 bows about the second month of the practice period, 108 bows every day as part of our practice. And that was the most challenging thing for me of the entire practice period. I started the 108 bows, did it for 3 days, and then had some physical limitations and had to then cope with the fact that my grit and determination were not enough. That was another teaching in and of itself. And we had a lecture around this and what that means. But essentially for me, bowing is always the letting go. And it's also the kindness. And it is the gratitude for the practice. And without those, and without Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, where would we be? So with regard to the teachings, I love a little bit of irreverence. And I like Dogen's Dogen's fascicle 192, where he says, small fish swallowed big fish. A Buddhist priest reads a Confucian text. Escaping from the net of Buddhas and demons, sweep away the dusts of the teachings. So please sweep away everything I just said and what is to come. There were some funny moments during the practice period, plenty of them, actually. I did keep a journal, and I look back at it now, and I think, what was I thinking? All I can do is count the days and think about food. Or mini panic, no Q-tips. Be irritation. What is real? My phone alarm, this actually happened, but I wrote it down. My phone alarm was trying to tell me to sleep more. It said at one point, please set a bedtime alarm so that you can get more regular sleep. But all right, tell that to the teacher. And Les's final teaching to me, which was really helpful during the last month when time seemed a little bit endless, was troublesome thoughts or delusion. And the best thing that worked for me constantly was just to say, it's a story. It's a story. Somebody once said, monasteries are places of petty intrigue. And, you know, you stay long enough with people in any setting, and stories start to come up in your head among other people. And if you just let them wash away with the creek, right? Let them wash away, just a story. And so that was helpful. I also wrote in my diary, excitement is when your Oriyoki cloths are dry at 4 p.m. You have to have them ready by 5 or 5:30 p.m. And you need to wrap your Oriyoki bowls again with wet cloths. It's no fun. I was really worried before I came home, really worried. People would look at me and wonder, how has she changed? And, you know, I have had a curiosity when people give these talks, you know, are they different? Does Tassajara make a difference? Is it worth going to? And, you know, I study people and think, you know, how have you changed? And so I mentioned that to somebody, and he said, just tell them I'm still me. And I am still me. So I want to close by also quoting Dogen again. Holding up a flower and smiling slightly is really making trouble. I like Dogen being critical. I resonate with that. He says, truly, Gautama created confusion in that scene. If you remember, that was the transmission scene. We simply need to hold each other's hands and visit the Buddha hall with eyebrows knit together. We just enter the monk's hall. Dave, should I turn off the mic here now?
No, that's how people will be heard. You'll be heard.
So keep all of this on right now.
Yeah, you just repeat any questions. Can you speak to the speaker?
Turn. Okay, just let me know if I need to change anything. Dave looks like he wants to. The speaker is, I don't know if the speaker's on. Yes, the speaker's on. Dave, do I need to repeat the question? Yeah. So Dave is asking about my experience with bowing and grit, and realizing that grit wasn't enough, and remembering a quote that I might need help with, but essentially that right effort is. Right effort is not a matter of grit. It arises when the right conditions are established. And what comes to mind is I've often thought about zeal and effort being zealous. And I think one of the things I realize is you burn out pretty quickly when you try to be zealous. And that right effort is wholesome action, ultimately. And right effort is, as you say, it's responding to conditions. It's inquiry and response coming up together. And so it's less about what we often think of in our society as being elbow grease, you know, that grit. It's more about being ready to respond. May. How did I sleep in Tassajara? Thank you for that question. the question was, how did I sleep in Tassajara? I slept enough. I think that's all I need to say. Thank you. And it's good to see you too.
What are some of the practices in monastic?
That's a great question. Thank you. So the question was, what are some monastic practices that you can bring into everyday life? I think the communal living, getting along with everybody, that was probably the thing that carried us through more than anything else. Because you can sit, but if you don't have the support of the community, you're not going to get the food, you're not going to have people to take care of you when you're sick. Not going to have people remind you to be compassionate to yourself. What else? In terms of monastic practice. Well, there's certainly, you know, just paying attention. That's the basic practice. It's harder to do, I think, when you don't have a quiet mind. And so having the opportunity, as we do here, to quiet our minds. And maybe there are ways we do it without sitting sometimes too, in everyday life, whether it's a walk, but we opportunities to quiet the mind, to be able to pay attention. I want to give people online a chance to ask questions too. Thank you, Philip. Go ahead.
I wanted to say, I love the, when you were talking about community and Les's advice to study, what was it, to study the Bodhisattva virtues. It was so beautiful the way your talk unfolded after that, talking about these incidents, these particular incidents, like the Tenzo getting up early to make pastry, but not even that spectacular. Just the kind of interactions that folks had in doing the daily life. It was just a beautiful illustration for me of not only Bodhisattva virtues, but what Buddhist community is like, is living like. I mean, this living opportunity to, and how that interaction kind of carries itself. I'm just grateful for the instruction and the way you revealed it in real life happening. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip. Can people hear that? Oh, good. Yeah. To just comment also, at one point in my long list of, it turned out to be many pages of virtues, Les, I took your instructions seriously to write down the virtues. And at the end, towards the end, one of the virtues that I wrote down was silence. Just that it felt like a virtue for people to create silence. I agree with the beauty of that communal spirit and the ability to have many different kinds of very simple experiences, even silence. Yeah. Anybody else online? Anybody else in the Zendo?
You're talking about
monastic living. I love it. Yeah, thank you. I was thinking about egos and how big egos get, though, in driving, but maybe that's also a reflection of our modern outside world. And yet, people still, I'm sorry, did people hear the question online? No, I'll repeat it. That traffic is an example of living in the modern world and applying monastic principles. Is that apt?
Yeah, and probably I want to emphasize most importantly is we're not talking to each other.
Right, and that people are not talking to each other.
They're working in space and time quite acutely.
And that we're working in space and time, and you made the point earlier that people still arrive at their destination and we're not bumping into each other as much as you would expect. Yeah, it's an interesting analogy.
I love, if I can say that, that it's not verbal.
You love that it's not verbal.
I mean, I definitely am verbal inside my car,
yeah.
But I'm not, it's not a transference receiver kind of verbal, it's like, gosh, all kinds of frustrations, and then, oh, that was really nice. Sort of a little bit of soliloquy going on in some ways, but not necessarily. But I like that it's movement, and it's in time and in space. It's dealing with our lives as modern beings and applying something of an ancient tradition.
So we get along still in our cars. We can still get along in our cars.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, Philip.
Leni, would you be willing to, it strikes me that it was a challenging practice period because there were not enough people to do all the functions, and yet you speak of it as being really positive, really and I wondered if you could talk about who led the practice period, who that was, and if I was wondering if there was the leadership had something to do with the spirit of the practice period, or maybe not. I just wondered.
Yeah, I think that there were times that were wobbly, and that those of us wondering how to deal with that tried to pull on our inner resources and say, we'll take responsibility for trying to make it work. So I think it was a collective effort of people trying to make it work. And it didn't always, you know, there were. A practice period is supposed to be a container without a lot of coming and going. And there was a lot of coming and going, and there were a lot of things that just kind of fell apart at times. But I think because people really had that sense of solidarity, it worked. Yeah. You had to have a kind of faith. I think I also appreciate the faith aspect of our practice. I came to Zen because it was experiential. And it kind of kept me. And I think I'm now more understanding of the importance of having faith that it and trust that things work out.
Thank you.
With a little bit of effort. You're welcome. The question is that I discovered ethics, and where does that come from? Yeah, I wouldn't say I discovered ethics. I looked for ethics and I had trouble finding them.
That's a big question.
Well, I don't mind saying a few words about it. So I thought that studying texts would give me some kind of a code. You know, we have the precepts and we have right ways of doing things, the Eightfold Path. And we have all sorts of other kind of guidances that are, you know, codes. But in the end, and then I should say there's also the monastic code, the Shingi, which is a set of instructions about how to behave in a monastery, which was probably the thinnest for me, you know, what time to go to bed and who should do what. But I think what it comes down to me is actually more similar to right effort, which is being able to respond.
You were talking about somehow taking on a moral place for somebody else, somebody else's action.
Oh, yeah.
That was really interesting.
Right. That was somebody who was concerned about taking responsibility. So the question was the ethics of taking on responsibility for somebody else's actions when you were involved. Yeah. Yeah. That one. So the conclusion that I personally drew and that we discussed was that it's a heavy burden to carry somebody else's stuff, and that we can have compassion for them, but ultimately it's our actions that we're responsible for. Yeah. So the question is about what is enough. Travis asked if I could say a little bit more about that and then say something about all the rain. So is it enough? You know, in the world of socially engaged Buddhism, there are debates about whether our practice of just sitting helps the world. You know, and I firmly believe it does. You know, I believe that sitting, that when I sit, there's something that's happening that's connected to everybody else and everything else. I believe that when I do metta or when we do loving kindness, that it really is creating some force. Even when, you know, Zazen itself is kind of a force that, when we are doing it, it's somehow amplifying to others. I really believe that. But I'm convinced it's also not enough to support social change, and that it's just as important to act in and respond to situations, but also proactively work with institutions, you know, work with individuals, do whatever work is necessary to support a good life that reduces suffering for others. So for me, it's about not just sitting, but taking action. And then the rain. You know, being a Tongariro student, not knowing any different, I think most of the Tongariro students took it in stride because it was just part of the challenge of everything else, kind of all rolled into one big package of, here I am, I'm just gonna do this no matter what. I'm gonna get through it. And the rain was high enough that one night they told us we might have to evacuate, but other than that, it wasn't a issue. Mostly it was a source of fascination and change, constantly changing water levels. The second month, you probably know this also, the second month when things come down and you have more headspace to kind of have your old habit patterns come back up, I think it became a bit of a bummer to have long periods of rain. But in the beginning, it was just part of the experience. Oh yeah, yeah, the road was closed. I don't even know how many weeks the road was closed, but the road was closed a number of times due to landslides and tree falls. There was snow. There was a foot and a half of snow at the pass. We had snow also. That was unusual, I guess. Did you have snow when
No.
you were there? Yeah. We woke up to beautiful, beautiful snow, you know, on Japanese buildings. It's especially pretty. And there was nothing, you know, the water rose high enough that some of the paths were flooded during during January. And as I said, they had to pull out the geothermal heat. So that was rough. In the Zendo, you could see your breath. I think it was 20 degrees for that week. So it was quite chilly. They told us we could wear hats and socks. That was nice. And I just think if there's anything else that actually affected us. Not really. You know, I was warm and dry most of the time. Yeah. At one point my robes got pretty wet, but that was just one day.
The thing with seeing your breath in the Zen reminds me of a movie I saw on YouTube, a film about the experience of being a monk at the Aegean.
Dave is making the point about seeing a film about a Heiji where the monks wake up at 4 a.m. and break the ice on the water to wash their face. And indeed, I used my hot water bottle after that month because I realized, and this is the thing, the longer you stay, you start making these accommodations that probably we shouldn't make. But I learned to wash my face with nice warm water in the morning. I don't know, but if you wash your face with a washcloth and warm water, I remember Norman Fisher saying this, and it affects me all the time. When I wash my face with warm water, I just feel, I don't know what I feel, but I feel something special. So warm water is a treat. Anybody else online? Thank you, everyone. Good night.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's kanndo.org.